set up some. So I talked today about some of the basic results that have been compared to data, and I wanted to at least set up some of these calculations and discuss them in more detail. So as I was telling you this morning, most of these things do not really rely on the way you implement this clock that will end up inflation. That doesn't really matter. So I will write things in this language. It's the so-called EFT of effective field theory of inflation kind of ideas. And a paper to start looking at that is this. And the references that follow. So I will more or less take that way of organizing things. I will discuss a little bit also the calculation of non-Gaussianities that is one of the things that have been constrained most recently by Planck, just to get a sense of what they mean. The first calculation of the first correct calculation, I would say, of these kind of things was done by Juan Maldacena, and the paper is old by now, 02106.03. I guess some of these things must be hepTH or astroPH or something. I don't remember. So this is prior to the dot being introduced into the archive, and so I will then discuss a little bit these departures from Gaussianity, what we can learn from them, and the different types of departures from Gaussianity that you can get. I'll just point some papers on these. Starting from some, these are just random collections of things from where I took things, but more modern applications. So these are all examples of calculations of non-Gaussianities in different examples where you learn, where you get a sense of what it is that you are learning when you measure this in the data. And I'll spend some time. I'll spend some time talking about the so-called consistency conditions. I hope I get to that. Of these non-Gaussianities in the case of single field inflation or the case I'm discussing here. And these are some examples of papers you can take a look. And this type of reasoning has been lately also applied not just to inflation, but the perturbations to make statements about. These are consistency conditions that relate some higher order endpoint function, for example, a three-point function in some particular limit with the two-point function. So it relates. They relate in general endpoint functions with lower order ones. And these same kind of arguments are now being applied even to large-scale structure, the development of structure, not just inflation, but in the late universe. And these are good things in this context because they provide some exact results that we know should be true regardless of... in the case of large-scale structure, the complication is that eventually you need simulations or some... the dynamics is more complicated, but still these kind of ideas have been used to prove results that should be valid, even in the simulations, and so just exact results, regardless of the problem with simulations is that the physics that is going into them is not understood. So they're not really, calling them simulations is a little bit of a, too much maybe. It's just the toy mall, I don't know what they are. But. Anyway, so those are examples where these kind of consistency conditions have been generalized to large scale structures. So okay, so let's get started. So my goal then is to compute or tell you how to compute the amplitude of fluctuations in the context of this inflationary cosmology in the example in which they are originated by the fluctuations of the clock that that tells the universe when to end inflation and where the fluctuations are quantum mechanics in nature. So what I need is to be able to write for you some sort of Lagrangian, starts by writing for you some sort of Lagrangian for the fields involved, and then do some computation. But now, I don't really want to talk about what the clock is. So how can I do that? So the way to do it is the following. So what I'm going to assume is that I have an FRW universe, and somebody has provided for me some history for it. H of t, Hubble constant as a function of time, is given for me, and is given by this clock. I don't know where this clock is coming from. And I want to study the the fluctuations, just these. There is always this mode of fluctuation where you just make this history back and forth. I want to study that mode of fluctuations, and but I know the history. So the way to do that is the first thing to do. I mean, it's just a trick to make sure that I know that I've written down all of the examples all at once is the following. So I can always choose coordinates. So there is this clock, whatever it is. So let me just choose coordinates such that you choose the time in my FRW universe. So choose the gauge so that this clock, whatever it is unperturbed in this coordinate. So whatever is the Lagrangian from this clock, I don't know, but I will and I will just choose the clock as the actual time in the for the metric. So so the clock is unperturbed, and so now the only other thing that I have the only other fields that I have floating around is the metric. So I have to write the most general action just involving the metric. Okay. But so I'm going to the unitary gauge in some sense. So in some sense, no, I'm going to the unitary gauge, and I only have the metric. But now I've lost the time diffeomorphisms as a symmetry. Okay, so I can, because I fixed the time to be this clock. Now the time is fixed. So I have to write. I would have to write all the invariants of the metric in my Lagrangian. But they not have to be invariant as usual, but they only have to be invariant under time dependent spatial diffeomorphisms. Okay, so so once I manage to write that, I do it in an expansion in derivatives and an expansion in the size of the in powers of the fluctuations, and in derivative that contains all inflationary models. Okay, so I just have to study this, and so what? So that's okay. So it's easy to do, and you can go to that paper to see all the terms, but let's just stick to the first few ones. So what are the things that I can write? Of course, I can write the same thing as I was writing before if I had all the diffs. So I can, of course, write the square root of g d4x. I can write the curvature. All the standard things I can still write because they're... But now I can write more things that I use. So the interesting things and where the matter, whoever is the clock, is hidden in this thing is the things that I can write now because I've lost the time diffeomorphism. So I can, of course, write any kind of function of time in front of things that I used to be able to write because time now is no longer, so I can write, I don't know, f of t times r, whatever I want like this, I can write. So these are new things that I can write because now, and then in terms of the metric, I can also write things with the, or tensors, I can write things, and this I leave you as an exercise, with the zero index up. So for example, G0, 0. That's, you just I leave you as an exercise to prove that this is a scalar under any time-dependent spatial diffeomorphism. Okay, so so these are the kind of terms that you can write. You can also write terms involving extrinsic curvature of these surfaces of constant time. So those have more derivatives than, for example, G0, 0. So an expansion of derivatives, things like the first non-trivial thing that you can start writing is this G0, 0, okay, for example. Now, this is not particularly mysterious. If you're coming from the example of that the clock is, so in the standard textbook, you would see that, oh, we're going to make inflation by having a scalar field. So I have some d mu phi square, so g mu nu, my metric will, the action would be this, minus v of phi, something. I study this example, okay? Now, I'm going to the gauge in which phi is the clock. In this example, this story goes like this. Phi is unperturbed, so instead of having So phi has a background, it evolves, and then usually, depending on what gauge you have, there's some fluctuations, okay? Now I go to the gauge in which phi is unperturbed, I choose the time to be this, and so phi is just phi bar, and so this term becomes g00, okay? Because phi just has the, so g00 plus phi bar dot square, okay? So this guy, for in that example, would just be this, okay? The cosmology, the cosmological, a term that is square root of g, some f of t times this term, that's just v of phi, right? So that's how the standard examples map into this way. But I'm not, I'm so I could have done this, probably it would have been simpler to me, for me to just study m square phi square or something, v of phi, but then, you might get the impression that some of the things depend in detail on that, and for the most part, they don't. So that's why I'm introducing it like this. But you can, the details you can find in this paper. But so once you do that, let me just write for you what you find to be the action with a lot of dot, because of course I'm writing now the most general action that I possibly can, and so it will be an expansion in derivatives and an expansion in so there'll be a lot of dot dot dots, but in any case, I will study the most simplest example for today. So I'm writing the action for the fluctuations for now. I'm solving for the space time g mu nu will be g mu nu of FRW plus some delta g mu nu. Okay, so and this would be the action for solving for the for this. Okay. Cube dot dot dot. Okay, and here more dot dot things that are here are curvature, like extrinsic curvature, things that have more derivative. And you, dot dot dots in this direction is so. Okay, let's look at this. So this is just the standard Einstein-Hilbert action. You can see these two terms. I'll discuss in just a second. They start linear in the so these guys start linear in the or and zeroth order and linear in the fluctuations and let's stop let me table them for a second, but really what I'm trying to write is the most general Lagrangian for fluctuations, so that starts quadratic. Let me just table for a second this part, but you can see I quadratic, cubic, so g00 plus 1 in FRW, g00 is minus 1. So this is delta g00 squared, delta g00 cubed. This has no derivatives. Now terms with the extrinsic curvature have more derivatives, so I can start writing things like here, so more derivatives, more powers of the fluctuations. I write anything that I want. Okay, what about here? So these guys start linear, but they are there to enforce the fact that this h of t that I'm given is the actual solution. Okay, so in reality, once I plug in g mu nu plus delta g mu nu into here, this is still quadratic in the fluctuations. These guys just are making sure that the g00 FRW with the a of t, with that a of t is the solution. These are tadpoles for doing that, so I need to fix them up. I need to fix them in terms of the solution that I'm given. So these are not really free things. C of t needs to be this thing. So they are fixed by the solution that I'm given, OK? So if somebody gives you, a given h of t, then this is the most general Lagrangian for the fluctuations in powers of the in powers of the fluctuations and derivatives. Okay, I didn't write the dot dot dot. You can go to this paper and see. Okay, but so great. And here you will see this h dot over h squared. This is the parameter epsilon that that we had before. Okay, so epsilon would be h dot over h squared minus. Okay, great. So now I need to study the fluctuation, the properties. I need to solve for the fluctuations. This is the most general case. The standard field, the slow roll inflation, the d square phi, m square phi square would just be dealing with the stuff in the this would be the d phi square. This would be the v of phi. Okay, but these are more other examples that anyhow. Great. So this is the most general Lagrangian, and so what do I need to do to study the fluctuations? So I will now, this is still invariant under spatial diffeomorphism, so let me just fix the gauge. Okay, so I will use the following. I will use ADM variables. So this will be the way I would write the metric. Write like this, and then I will use the spatial diffeomorphisms to set hij to be delta ij a square of te to the 2 zeta of x and t, okay? There's also the tensor. For now I will only study this scalar mode of fluctuations, okay? The clock going back and forth. In more generality, I would also, I've put to zero tensor fluctuations, okay? Just because I don't want to copy so many equations, okay? But if you go. Okay, so this is, I'm going to use a gauge in which the metric looks like that. So what do I need to do? I need to write down some sort of, these are my degrees of freedom. In reality, the degree of freedom really is clear, just the zeta variable over here, because when you plug this into there and you solve for n and ni, you write the equations, Einstein equations for n and ni, they are just constrained variables. So you can solve for n and ni in terms of zeta and plug it back into the action, and you will end up with an action for zeta. Okay? So the scalar degree of freedom of the clock is just in this gauge, is just this variable zeta. Okay? So what I need to do now is do that. So yes. So, okay. So, for example, in the metric, no, they need to be. So, you, the exercise that you need to do, it should be things that are invariant under. I still have. Time-dependent spatial diffeomorphisms to as my freedom. So if you can go through that exercise, and these are the only things that you're left that you can write. So, I mean, okay, perhaps you can propose something, and then we can check. But or you can go to this paper. But that's. These are, it's just, yeah, the everything that you can write consistent with these. So, yeah, they still need to be invariant. Okay, so, great. Any other question? No? So if I do that, so what I do, I plug this into there, okay? I write the equations for n and ni, and so n is 1 plus delta n, for example. I solve for delta n, I solve for ni, that the clearest place to follow all this algebra is the paper by Juan, I think. So for example, delta n ends up being zeta dot over h. You plug this back into you plug this back into the action for zeta and so on. And you discover the following thing. So ni, well, I can write for you what they are if you want. Ni is di of some potential, and the potential, the Laplacian of this potential is given by minus the Laplacian of zeta over h. Oh, here is using real rho dot, I think is h. A square epsilon zeta dot. Okay, I am converting as I go along from from the notation I have here, and I will start it. So h may, you know, maybe some little factor, but roughly speaking, it's like this. Okay, so great. So you do that. What do you discover? Okay. So now this Lagrangian starts quadratic in the fluctuation, cubic, blah, blah, blah. Let's start by looking at the quadratic Lagrangian, and then I will discuss the cubic Lagrangian later, okay? So if you look here, if we stick with the things with the smallest number of derivatives, we are looking at the end of the day, what we see in the sky today we will see it gets generated when these modes are of the size of the horizon at the time. So that's the low energy limit. So anything that I write with more derivatives will be quite suppressed in its effect, except if I unless I crank it up in some way. There are some examples, but for the most part. If all these terms are present here and you just add these other things are usually very negligible. So let's start by talking about the things with the smallest number of derivatives. Things that are quadratic are coming from here. Once I plug in this metric into here, I'll get a given that h of t is, I pick c in this way, this part will start quadratic in the fluctuations, and then there is this additional piece that can be quadratic too, g00 plus 1 squared. These are cubic and higher order, and these are higher derivatives. So if I want to stick with the lowest number of derivatives and quadratic Lagrangian, these are the terms that I need to start to look at. Okay, and let me discuss this in just a second. But first, let's look at what is the action. What is the quadratic Lagrangian after you do this, if we have this m of t equals to 0, okay? And then what you discover is the following, okay? So this is just an exercise that you can follow. So epsilon, remember, is h dot over h squared. Okay, so okay, great. So the action for the scalar fluctuation is just a free field. Okay, of course plus the cubic Lagrangian, which I'm not writing, but it's a massless scalar field. Okay, in the Sitter background, that's what it is. Okay, the fact that it's massless, so it's always massless. This mode of fluctuation. This has nothing to do with whether you made, say, for example, you made this clock out of a scalar field with some mass. It doesn't matter. The mode of the scalar fluctuation, this advancing, it costs you nothing to advance, and you know it only costs to the extent that there is a gradient. So all the cost of advancing or delaying the clock is just gradients. It's always a massless thing. And so now, if I want to know what's the size of the fluctuations that I will observe, I need to study a massless scalar field in the De Sitter. Okay. which I guess maybe most of you know. So if you want in terms of a canonically normalized scalar field, you can see here, I mean, where I'm great. So if I want to define some sort of canonically normalized scalar field, it would be something like M Planck times the square root of epsilon times zeta. Okay, so if I define this as a scalar field, this would be the d phi square thing that you would find in any book. Okay, oops. Great. And so some of you may know this already, that that if you study the the two-point function of a scalar field in the vacuum in the sitter, then a canonically normalized scalar field is two-point function, it's just given by h squared. So if you know that result from here, you immediately read what is the size of the fluctuations of zeta. Okay? It would be h squared divided by this. Okay? Great. So should I do that calculation? Maybe not. But so let me. This, I knew this was going to drive me. There must be another one, right? Oh, it's in here. No, I was not saying. Great. Okay. So so at this level, this is just a free field, right? So if I just wanted to study the two-point function of this thing in the vacuum, what I need to do, I solve its equation, the classical equation. I have a bunch of harmonic oscillators. I quantize this, okay? So this you all know how to do. Let me just, I want to point out a few things. So when you solve the equation for zeta, the classical equation for zeta, zeta classical, apart from the normalization, its time dependence looks something like this. So you can normalize later, but so here eta is conformal time, so a d eta is dt of the metric that I wrote there. And during inflation, eta is going through to zero. Okay, eta equals to zero is the end of inflation, it's coming from negative values to zero. Okay. One thing that I want to point out about this solution is that when you go towards eta equals to zero, so when k eta is much smaller than one, zeta goes to a constant. When k eta goes to zero, zeta goes to a constant. Okay, and that constant is the size of the fluctuations that we see in the sky. But a point that I want to mention this at this point for the following reasons. So if zeta is a constant in time, let's go back to this formula. Zeta plays a very similar role as A of t, as the scale factor. Okay? So zeta, a constant, is just a redefinition of the scale factor. It's like a nothing, okay? It's so when zeta goes to a constant, it's locally an unobservable thing, okay? So and if zeta goes to a constant, n goes to one. So when you can see from here, so when zeta is constant, then what you have here is just the unperturbed FRW universe with just the same as you had before, with a rescaled coordinate, okay? So if you were a local observer trying to make some measure at that time when zeta became constant, you cannot really tell that there was any zeta. Okay, it's just a redefinition of the coordinate. It just means that what you're calling x in different parts of the universe corresponds to different physical distances. Okay, that's what this zeta is. So these modes freeze with some amplitude when k eta goes to zero, and at that time they become locally completely unobservable if you were there. Okay. What else do I want to point out about that? I will not I think this will have some consequences when we discuss this consistency condition. This is the what goes into this consistency condition. But and what does it reflect? It reflects this. You know, when inflation was introduced in the very beginning, it was introduced so that whatever things that were any inhomogeneity that was there at the beginning, it would get redshifted away, and we would not see it anymore. Okay, so it was an attractor solution. Wherever you started with, you end up with the same space-time. This is exactly what this is. The reason this is happening, even if you have at some point some fluctuation, it goes outside the horizon and it's completely unobservable. You go back to the exact same FRW history, whether this fluctuation was there or not, because it just goes into a gauge mode, okay? So it's the attractor nature of the inflationary solution that it's making this happen. So that's
an important point that if we discuss the consistency condition, we will see.
And so rather than doing the exercise of writing this, the classical solution, the bunch of harmonic oscillators, A dagger, A whatever, all of these standard story, let me just, because that will take me too much time, let me just guesstimate the size of the zeta fluctuations from quantum fluctuations just by order of magnitude, okay? So let's say that's the action. So we are trying to compute zeta square, okay? That would be the two-point function that I'm trying to compute for the fluctuations. So, and I'm talking about the vacuum fluctuations on a zeta of a given wave number lambda, okay? So, what are the vacuum fluctuations? How do I guesstimate the size of these fluctuations? Well, the action integrated over one wavelength, over one frequency time, is going to be one, okay? That's how you get the size of the quantum fluctuation. So I get, just from there, M Planck square, epsilon, I integrate over one wavelength, lambda cubed, I integrate over one period, time would be, lambda would be this, time would be the period, okay? And then zeta dot square would be omega square zeta square, okay? So this is, let me just take the dot piece, okay? So integrate over one wavelength and one period, okay? This is the action. This will be of order one for the vacuum fluctuations. And I evaluate this at the time. So this guy eventually becomes constant. So evaluate this at the time when K eta is of order one. So lambda, the period is going to be the Hubble time, and lambda is going to be the same. I mean, C is one. It's propagating at the speed of light. So here you have your formula for zeta square. It will be what? It will be T times one omega. So anyway, so exercise, you will find just by dividing from the other side, A square over M Planck epsilon. Okay, it will be proportional to this. And this is the formula that we had before. Okay. That's how it works. But you can do it with the more carefully if you want. So let's go back to this term, okay? So this term starts quadratic in the Lagrangian, so it will affect this two-point function, and of course this it starts quadratic, it's delta G00 square, but there's a square root of G, so it also leads to some interactions, okay? But it starts quadratic. What does this term do? So from here, you see delta G00 is zeta dot, okay? So if I include this term, what I'm doing is changing the action here, adding a term proportional to zeta dot square, okay? So in other words, changing the relative size of these two terms, or equivalently making these waves propagate at a speed that's not the speed of light. Okay, so if you have this, all that's happening is that the fluctuations are not propagating at the speed of light, but at some other speed. Okay, and so you can, so in other words, you can change, you can solve for what that speed is and express this in terms of that speed. Okay, so this guy is the parameter that allows you to make the fluctuations propagate at a different speed. And notice that if you want to make them travel much slower, I mean, of course, faster than the speed of light, no. Okay, but if I want to make them propagate slower than the speed of light, what I need to do is to crank up this zeta dot square, okay, term, so that the propagation speed will be smaller. And so this means that I need to crank up this value. Okay, the larger I make this, the lower the slower the waves are. Okay, but this term is not just quadratic. It will be it's cubic and quartic and whatever. It has all the orders. But so I'm bringing this up because this is the way how we now know or have a constraint of the speed of propagation of these waves, of these fluctuations during inflation. Because if the speed of propagation was much smaller than the speed of light, say a tenth of the speed of light, this number, I would have to crank it up so much that the interactions that come from these terms are already ruled out by Planck. Okay? So the way we try to understand how well, you know, what is the speed of propagation of these fluctuations during inflation is by studying the non-Gaussianities for the reason that I just said. Okay? Any questions? No? Okay. Great. Blah, 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 blah. So what will happen if you so if you add this here and change the name so this m to the fourth will you take out some m Planck and an epsilon and there's an h square from here you change the name and m to the fourth you write it in terms of cs times this value times m Planck and h square. What you find is that the action ends up being the following. Cs here and 1 over Cs or Cs squared here. Cs is the speed of propagation, okay? 1 over Cs squared. So here is where you see that if you want to make things propagate slower than the speed of light, then you are making 1 over the CS squared, the parameter in zeta dot, you're making it big. And then when we look at the cubic Lagrangian, you will see the cubic terms that are inherited from here, they will be boosted by a 1 over CS squared, okay? In other words, this is happening because in order to make things, the term that I'm changing is the zeta dot term. So in order to put a CS here, I have to take it out, okay? So, anyhow, okay, great, blah, blah, blah. And so in the end, this will mean that the formula for in a case like this, the formula for the amplitude of fluctuations now will also have CS in them because it's norm, you know, you now repeat the same exercise as before or change coordinates so as to remove the CS. And then you will find that the formula there looks like a squared over m Planck epsilon CS. Okay, one CS in the denominator for the amplitude of fluctuations. Okay, great. So, maybe here. So, what about the cubic Lagrangian? So, of course, there's cubic, quartic, and so on. But let's stop with the cubic. And then again, this is just a super tedious calculation, and you have to do it. So, what you have to do is just plug this into here and expand to the third order, okay? Just not particularly enlightening, but you have to do it if you want to. And this is, yeah, this the best place for this is Juan's paper.
Great. So
let me just write down some of the terms that you get. So you get a cube epsilon over cs squared, 1 over cs squared, epsilon minus 3. Okay, things like this. I mean, it's just zeta. For example, you get something like this, okay? So how do we estimate? And then what you need to do is use this. For example, we would want to calculate if there is a cubic vertex. We want to compute the three-point function of zeta, and in a second I'll tell you a little bit more how to do this calculation, perhaps. But if you just want to estimate the size of non-Gaussianity, so this is so let me divide the three-point function of zeta by its two-point function to the 3/2. So this has the same number of zetas in the numerator and in the denominator. Okay, so it's some sort of dimensionless measure of how non-Gaussian the field is. Okay. And this is the thing that we can directly constrain with the observations. And roughly speaking, if you have measured a certain number of pixels in the sky or modes in the sky of zeta, you can constrain this skewness, it would be, or something like that, in the distribution of zeta to an accuracy which is proportional to the 1 over the number of numbers that you measure, the number of pixels on the sky. So this would be equivalent if you have some distribution for some variable, just one variable x, some p of x, then, you know, computing this, I mean, a measure of, so it's almost a, it looks like almost like a Gaussian distribution. This would be a measure of how not Gaussian it is, you know, how well you can constrain this will, of course, depend on the number of samples of x that you have, right? So it would be 1 over the square root. I mean, it's not the 1. I think it's 6 or something. I don't forget. But roughly speaking, number of samples, okay? So this is the exact same story here where samples turn into pixels. And this constraint, this number is a million. So you can imagine that if you were to plot, you know, if you had a million samples, if you had not detected anything, and you plotted an example of a distribution which, you know, had exactly at that upper limit, it was not Gaussian at this upper limit, you wouldn't even be able to tell, okay? Because it's so would be look like a super Gaussian. You have to try doing that in Mathematica, you will not see anything. You have to zoom in. So we know it's very Gaussian. It's very, very Gaussian. But that's from the observational side. But if I wanted to estimate, so we can do the calculation in detail. But if I wanted to estimate this, so one way of doing the estimate, and that, apart from numerical coefficients, is what you get is to take the ratio, evaluate the cubic Lagrangian at the time of, just as I got the amplitude of fluctuations by evaluating the action at the time of horizon crossing, this level of non-Gaussianity is related to the typical size of the cubic Lagrangian over the quadratic Lagrangian, again, at this time of freeze-out. So you just plug in into the formula there. You take the ratio of that to the quadratic Lagrangian at the time when the mode K over A, which is the frequency of the mode, if you were well inside the horizon. If this is Hubble, in the formula that I gave you, the time K eta of order 1, you evaluate this, and that's kind of the size of the non-Gaussianities that you will find. And let me tell you what is the, so when you just take that ratio, for example, with the term that you have there, this is what you find. Let me just first, the standard case when CS is equal to 1, everything propagates at the speed of light. This would be the case, for example, if I had started this discussion by looking at an example like m squared phi square, you know, a scalar field, blah, blah, blah. This is example there, the propagation would be 1. And what I get for this ratio is epsilon times zeta. So the ratio of this cubic to quadratic Lagrangian, the cubic Lagrangian has three zetas, as you can see there. The quadratic Lagrangian has two zetas, so the ratio of the two is epsilon times zeta. Okay, this is 10 to the minus 5, but so epsilon. Okay, so this the level of the non-Gaussian is not just 10 to the minus 5, but 10 to the minus 5 times epsilon. Okay, so it's really tiny, and this conclusion has nothing to do with m square phi square or nothing. Whatever I do, this is okay. This is what comes out. If, on the other hand, I start making the propagation speed much smaller than the speed of light, then I'm cranking up this term. This term leads to interactions, and you will get, there will be also these sizes, but the big thing would look like 1 over CS squared times zeta, okay? So then it would be 10 to the minus 5 times something bigger. Okay, bigger than 1. And so this is how we know that CS is, more than 0.1 or something, the speed of light, something like that is the bound from Planck. I forget now the latest number. But we haven't seen these any departures from Gaussian. So we know the speed is higher than something. Okay? And it's just coming from this argument. Great. So let me not do the tensor modes. And good. So any questions so far? Sure. No questions? No? Yeah?
Can you explain to me the variables again, infinite square, epsilon, lambda,
cube? Okay, so I said for doing the estimate, I said I'm looking at various Fourier modes, okay? They have wave number lambda or wavelength lambda or wave number k equals 2 pi over lambda, whatever. Okay, standard formula. Okay, and so to get the estimate of the size of the fluctuations, what will be the case is that the action for this mode will be roughly when I integrate over one wavelength, the volume. So the action is the integral d cube x, d cube t. So in the vacuum, when I do this integral over one wavelength and over the period, one period, I will get 1. Okay. So from the d cube x, I get a lambda cube. From the dt, I get a big T. Then the action looked like m Planck square times epsilon, okay, times zeta dot square. So zeta dot is zeta times the frequency omega, or an omega is the same as k. Okay, omega square zeta square. I was interested in the amplitude of fluctuations at that time. This will be of order 1, okay? And so, but omega at the time when, so this time k eta equals to 1 is the time when k over a is Hubble, okay? So omega, the frequency of these waves, is Hubble. And the wavelength is Hubble. So lambda is Hubble, T is 1 over Hubble, or lambda is 1 over Hubble. So all of these guys are just Hubble to some power. And so you can see that one of the T's and one of the omegas go away. Okay. So then you just go from there. Okay. Any other questions?
Yeah.
Yeah.
The second mass cell you have in the cubic term for the T00, the one on the right, does that also show up in number channels?
Yeah. So what I've done here is relabel. So if you look at this term, is what? M to the fourth, and then delta G00 squared, which delta G00 is zeta dot over h, zeta dot square over h square, okay? Now, for this to be the speed, so this will change the speed of sound by how much? So if this term, if I call this epsilon m Planck square 1 over CS squared, zeta dot squared, then this will be the new speed of propagation. So from here, you read that m is h squared, m Planck squared epsilon, divided by CS squared. So if you make, if you want the thing to propagate slower than the speed of light, then you have to crank up this m, okay? Any other question? So this, no? This result of the connection between the speed of propagation of the waves of these fluctuations at inflation and the non-Gaussianity, it's one of the nice results that we had in the field that allowed us to try to understand what gives us some constraint on what was happening in inflation. Notice that had we only measured the two-point function, we wouldn't know. Let me just say the following thing. So the question that thanks to that connection, we've been able to figure out or constrain the dispersion relation of these modes, right? So if I wrote, had I only measured the two-point function, I wouldn't be able to know what the CS is, because for a given wave, so what will happen in a universe, or what happens when you solve for the, so I gave you somewhere that it's behind this, the solution for, in the case where CS is equals to 1. If CS is smaller, the story is exactly, the solution is almost the same. It's just the only difference that instead of, in the standard case, when omega is of order, or in both cases, when omega, the transition between the solution was some oscillatory solution that went into some constant, okay? That I wrote here, okay? Sorry. This is some, at sufficiently early times, remember eta goes from minus infinity to zero. When you go to minus infinity, these are standard oscillatory modes inside of the horizon flat space. You know, k eta going to is just the standard thing. Okay, then you transition to a constant. You transition to a constant at the time when, remember that this eta is not time, right? So there's a's floating around, but you transition into this constant when the frequency of the mode. So the wavelength of the mode is getting stretched by the Hubble, by the expansion, and so the frequency is getting lower and lower and lower. There comes a time when the frequency is of order Hubble. That's the time when you transition to this constant. Okay, in the case where the CS, and up to this point, if you wanted another way of getting the amplitude of the fluctuations that I estimated in this other way, you just take the standard flat space vacuum fluctuations. In any case, you're expanding things adiabatically. So it's just use this formula and plug in where you say frequency, you plug Hubble, and then you get the right answer, because in any case, the expansion for the point of view of these modes is adiabatic, is very slow. So what will happen in the case where the dispersion relation was like this would be exactly the same story, with the only difference, you will still, when the frequency is of order Hubble, you will transition to this constant. The only difference is that the wavelength of the mode will be different, because omega at the point of the transition, omega will be Hubble, but the CS is smaller, and so the lambda is the wavelength at the moment of the freeze-out, the wavelength is slightly smaller. But we don't know that. How do we know? So it will, and then when you look at the amplitude of the fluctuations at that moment of the freeze-out, it will be different. It will be bigger by this 1 over CS, okay? But we just measure some, how would we know, right? So it's just, so by measuring the two-point function would still be scale invariant in the exact same way, because that just has to do with time translation invariance during inflation. So this is just as good. So would be completely consistent to have any speed of propagation if we just measure the two-point function. is this connection between the two-point function, this general connection between the speed of propagation and higher interaction terms that allows us to know that CS has to be bigger than something. And had we been able to get to FNLs these constraints a little bit, you know, probably 10 times better than we have them now, we would have already known that it's propagating at the speed of light. Now, where is this connection coming from? Okay, these are the math, but where is it coming from? In the case of a scalar field move. So if it's moving, if you think of the picture of the scale, the clock is made by a scalar field. So how is it? Why is it propagating? How can you make it propagate slower than the speed of light? You will make it propagate if you add interactions. So imagine there are some sort of interactions between the scalar, you know, some diagram involving some interaction with the scalar, and you put two of these guys. So now we have the scalar plus its fluctuations. Okay, you put two of these guys in the background. Okay, so let's say this is some sort of vertex d phi square times something d phi square times something sigma over some other guy in the intermediate. It could be gravity, whatever. It could be sigma, some interaction. Okay, so if I put two of these guys into the background, then I have some correction for the propagation of the fluctuation, so delta phi. And the more I interact with the background, the more I can slow it down. Okay. And what is the diagram that is giving me the non-Gaussian is when I do this, okay? So if, you know, there is this guy, there's also this guy. This is a cubic vertex, okay? And this is the connection, okay? So it's always the case if you are doing something like this you are slowing down by interacting with the background, then you remove in one of these places the background, and then you have a cubic interaction for the fluctuations. And so you will generate some non-Gaussianity, okay? And if you start with this, you will discover exactly this kind of. So it's really much. It's more. I mean, if you're not propagating at the speed of light, it's because you realize that you are in some sort of medium, right? That you are there's somebody that's telling you respect to what the propagation, okay? So you are interacting with this medium that's setting the background, and but then. Associated with this, there will always be some 3-point function. Okay, because so here in the if you wanted to change the speed of propagation, so in this case, let's say we integrate this guy out, it will be some d phi to the fourth kind of term, in which in two places you put let me write d phi square. Okay, in two of these places I put five, so I get phi bar dot delta phi dot squared. Okay, and so this is a delta phi dot square for something that will change the speed of propagation of the fluctuations. Okay, but then I just put it in one of them and not the other. Have a cubic vertex. Okay, that's basically. I mean, at least in this example, that's what's going on. Any question? But it's general, okay? If I'm going, and it's general, it's not just about the speed of propagation. If I do anything else that will, so for example, there are people in this examples, so-called warm inflation. It happens that you dissipate some energy into some bath, so you're interacting with some bath and dissipating some energy, okay? The moment you're, there will be similar relations because, in that case, your fluctuations will decay. So even if you have and there will be similar situation. You're breaking. You're interacting with this background. There will always lead by similar arguments to some
departure from Gaussianity. So this departure from Gaussianity, you know, just in general allows you to know things about the even the if you are changing even the quadratic Lagrangian from just a scalar field from a massless speed of light propagation scalar field, you will always introduce some. You're doing this by interaction with the background, and so you can always take one of these backgrounds out, and then you would see something in the non-Gaussianities. Okay, so let any questions? Yeah.
Yeah. Are you saying that if the non-Gaussianity were pushed below a certain level, you could falsify inflation?
Yeah. It depends on your definition of falsify and of inflation. And no, but definitely this, of course. Yeah. For example, this. This is kind of definitely. The thing is, this is very far from our.
But it's interesting to have a rigorous lower bound.
Yes, it's.
Has someone written that down?
Oh yeah. Yes. Okay. I mean, this is the thing. Is that it's so low.
Someday we'll get there.
Well, okay. Let me just say two things. So definitely you can. But the problem is that no matter, so okay, what is the lowest level? So I can always crank up the non-Gaussianity, okay? But let's forget, so for example, the speed of sound or something or other. But let me just say I don't crank up anything. So I'll get some non-zero value, okay? And you would say, if I don't see this, I would falsify inflation. But it's, you know, what are these interactions coming from? These are the gravitational level interactions that are always there, okay? So anything else, I don't know how you're going to do the fluctuations, will have, in fact, they will always have it much bigger, okay? I think if we get to this level and we haven't seen any non-Gaussianity, we would have eliminated everybody else before we get to eliminate inflation. And okay, abracadabra string theory comes like this, then it's not eliminated. Because, but other than that, but because notice, okay, maybe this was not what I was going to say, but let me say that.
We can talk about this later. Don't get too far.
No. But I think it's a good time for me to say. So because if not, I mean, probably something will go off of this list. So may as well say this. So let me comment on this. So the level of non-Gaussianity is epsilon times zeta. So this epsilon here is super small, okay, or a small number. Is this surprising? Yeah, I think of the following, and perhaps people that are familiar with. Large scale structure later on. Let's think about our universe now. Okay, so if we think about our universe now. Let's say there is a long wavelength fluctuation in the density somewhere. Okay, this universe over here is slightly more curved than, let's say, slightly denser than the universe over there. Things here happen slightly at a different rate, the universe slightly different. How just this effect of the difference in the energy density here compared to there, the Hubble is different, everybody's different. How big an effect does it make it? So how big non-Gaussianities do we get from that? We get, if we divide this, the same cubic thing of the late universe over the quadratic, we get 1 for this, not epsilon, or 1 times zeta. Okay, because this universe is
zeta here, the Laplacian of zeta is like the curvature of, so the, this looks, if this is a very long wavelength mode, this is a universe with a different curvature. And if the if you just think of the anything that you calculate in our universe, it depends on the curvature with an order one. So you take a Taylor expansion, you get a one here. How come we not even get a one here? Notice that epsilon can be really very small. How come we don't even get a one? How come? It's because this zeta is not, so you get a one whenever this fluctuation is, like it is now in our universe, a change in the density, a change. But at that time, during inflation, this fluctuation was not changing the density or anything at all. In the limit epsilon equals to zero, phi is just a test scalar taking time. It's just a change in the coordinates of a perfect de Sitter space, okay? And so there's no difference in the limit epsilon going to zero. There's no difference between one, even though there is this fluctuation, there's no difference locally of anything. It's just the same density or anything. That, so in every other example, you start, you will, and notice that perhaps I'll make another comment. So what we see today is consist, you know, let's say at the end of the day, you produce the fluctuation however you want. It will, you need to produce this zeta, okay? This zeta looks like the scale factor, okay? So if you want to produce this zeta, what you need to do, zeta as a function of x, is just meaning that some regions of the universe expanded more than others, okay? So that from one given time or one to the other, the scale factor changed by different amounts. That's the now, today, how we can do that? We can do this by changing the equation of state of the universe such that the rate of the amount of expansion when you go from density one to density two, if the pressure is different, you will get different amounts. But then, you know, then you're changing the equation of state, you're changing the properties of the universe, so you will get order one. So this is a way of making, during inflation, you can change the amount of expansion without changing the equation, without changing energy densities or pressures appreciably, and then you get this minuscule non-Gaussianity. So, I mean, what I can say is that in, for sure, I don't know to what extent this is a complete theorem, but if you just look at examples, every example that has been written down of other things have here much bigger, okay? So my sense is that if we were to get to this level, everything else would be gone by then, so it would be real trouble. Okay, any other question? Okay, so let me spend the last few minutes talking about this consistency condition, which is related to this. Okay. So I will not derive the formula for the 3-point function. I'll refer you to the paper by Juan, but it's just. You just have to do the calculation, okay? With that Lagrangian that I gave you, you have the interaction Hamiltonian, you just go for it, and you'll get something. And what you get has the following, I won't even write it in too much detail. I will write it so, like, in the following way. Zeta, zeta, zeta has two pieces. So this is some function, so, okay. Let me be more. I'm computing the expectation value of this variable zeta at three wave numbers. Okay, by translation invariance, this is proportional to delta function. You know, all the things need to add up to zero. Okay, and then there is some function here of k1, k2, and k3. Okay, but they all add up to zero. Okay, so I'll tell you about the properties of this. Okay, great. So this f, we call it the bispectrum. In this, when you do the calculation in this example, it has two pieces. So two different structures as a function of k. Okay, so And you know the parameters that in it's all based on this everything all that I'm specifying. Let me for the moment just put CS equals to one. I can tell you what happens later. But all that you have is the history. And so in terms of the history, there's two pieces, two functions of K, different, that have very different properties. And I will tell you what about them is different in just a second. One of them is proportional to this ns minus 1, and one is proportional to this epsilon. Okay, this piece, we call it a local piece. And this is an equilateral piece. Okay. And what I've been discussing so far is this epsilon is the part over there. But there's also this other piece. S minus 1, remember, is the... So this is the result of Juan's calculation. And remember that ns minus 1 is the how... So the amplitude of fluctuations, the two-point function, was proportional to k to the ns minus 1. So ns minus 1, which was a combination of this epsilon and its rate of change. So this parameter is just related to the departures from scale invariant. We have measured this to be, you know, ns to be 0.96 or something like that. And epsilon, we only have upper limits of around 0.1. It's smaller than 0.1, OK? What about these two structures as a function of k? What is different about them? So if you look at that, at this and consider the three-wave numbers, there's the limit in which one of the k's is very, very small compared to the other two, for example. Or let's take the limit, another example where the three k's are more, they add up to zero, right? So k1, k2, k3 add up to zero, more or less the same size. This one is much smaller. K1, let's say, is much smaller than K2 and K3, OK? So this you can think of this as the K1 being a very long wavelength mode, OK? And if you see in the data, if you were to see such a thing, what would it mean? So you have the K1, which is a long wavelength mode. You now, K2 and K3 are very small, are very large, so a small wavelength. So this, if they added, so the two-point function, on the other hand, is just given by K. So the two-point function would be K1 minus K1, okay? That would be, so this diagram is telling you how the two-point function of the field is varying on the long wavelength. So if this is non-zero, another interpretation of that would be that if you took a little region and measure the two-point function here, and you took a little region and took a two-point function there, you would measure different values. Okay? If that would be the case, it's the same as saying that in the three, so there's a correlation between, you measure the two-point function here, some two k's like that, which are the high k's, the long mode is the other one. Okay? So saying that there's a bispectrum that looks like that is the same, mathematically the same, as saying that the two-point function varies in space. Okay? So this term is non-zero in this limit. Okay? So this, while this guy is not, so in this guy in this limit goes to zero. So this part only correlates three things that are more or less of the same size. Okay? This one is proportional to epsilon. This proportional to ns minus 1. Okay? And this consistency condition is nothing other, is saying that it's always going to be the case that what in single field in this single clock inflation, there's always going to be ns minus 1 here, regardless of what. So what I told you, this equilateral piece, if there is a speed of sound, there is a CS square here. Okay. So this part is non-universal. If you start changing the interactions and so on, you can make this bigger and smaller. And from looking at this, is that we constrain the speed of sound. Okay. So it really, well, so this is epsilon plus some term that goes like 1 over CS square if CS is small. So if CS is 1 or minus 1 or something like that. So if CS is 1, it's just epsilon. If not, it could be much bigger. So this sits in front of here. And it's when I correlate three modes of the same size. This guy is completely universal. I cannot do anything here to change an S minus one, okay? So this is why this is called a consistency condition. And notice that an S minus one is the property of a two-point function. The rate of change of the two-point function with scale is related to a certain limit of the three-point function, okay? And since this, in subsequent years, a lot of these consistency conditions involving higher order the endpoint function have been derived, okay? This is the simplest example. Now, where is this coming from? And why it is interesting? So this particular value, I would say, is the equivalent of saying zero, okay? So in other words, in this, the way we usually state the calculation, we get this value, but in the words, is the same as saying that if I make an experiment and measure the two-point function here, I should get exactly the same value as I get here. So because of the choice of gauge, in order for in the observables or in to be no effect, I need to get a non-zero value here. Why is that? Because remember that, let's see, do I still have the metric somewhere or I threw it out? Yeah, I threw it out. So remember that, where is that? Here. Remember what the space-time looks like, okay? So, it ended up being something like this. When the mode was frozen outside the horizon, it looked like something like this. Okay, zeta of x. I mean, was no longer changing with time. Okay, so let's consider a very long wavelength mode of zeta here. So in this region, zeta has some certain constant value. Okay. Here has some other different constant value, okay? What does this mean? It means that what I'm calling x is a different thing in the two places, okay? So now, to do a fair comparison, I should say, what is the amplitude of the two-point function, not in an arbitrary commoving scale, which is what I computed there. The k was the Fourier transform of this x. X is, I don't know, just some coordinate. Let me do some physical question. Let me ask if I don't know, if I compare the amplitude of fluctuations on a scale that encloses such an amount of mass or something, some physical question here, not in terms of x. So if I compare the two-point function here at a given physical distance to the two-point function here at the given physical distance, I will get the exact same number. Now, in those variables, I get a different, in these variables, I get a different value because, in other words, let me just say some k physical in both places is given by what? Is given by so x is e to the zeta times x, right? So it's some, in the two places, so the k over e to the zeta in the value, let me say that here is zeta 1 and here is zeta 2, okay? So when in the region 1, if I want to get a specific physical wave number, the k that I need to pick in these coordinates is different in the two regions because the value of zeta, my coordinates, are different. So if I want to compare the power at the same physical wavelength, I need to pick different k's, okay? And so because I'm picking different, or equivalently, maybe the best way to say this is the following. When I did this calculation, I'm not asking the question of what is the power at the same physical scale, but I'm asking what is the power at the same commoving k. That was the calculation. I was just doing something at a fixed k. But a fixed k means two different physical wave numbers in the two places, the amplitude of fluctuations as a function of the physical wave number that somebody will measure goes like ns minus 1, okay? So when I compare the power here and here at two different, at the same k's, they correspond to two different k physical, and so the power will be slightly different proportional to ns minus 1 just from varying this, okay? So that value is exactly what you need in order for the observables in terms of physical variables to be the same in both places. And this is kind of obvious that this is what needed to happen, and this is why it always happened regardless of what you do with the Lagrangian, because of the following. Remember, like the plot that I did in the morning. So there was the Hubble, and there were different scales freezing, okay? So first, so in this squeeze limit, the long wavelength, the bigger guy, comes out of the horizon in inflation first. I told you when something comes out of the horizon, it goes, zeta goes to a constant, okay? So from the point of view of what's going to happen next, this is a completely unobservable thing. There's nothing there happening that anybody can see. In particular, the mode, that is the next guy, cannot see, sees the exact space-time, whether this froze in some way or in some other way, okay? So the amplitude of fluctuations of the next guy, which has to do with the history at the time of its horizon crossing, is identical whether this mode is there or not, because this one is already gone, and the attractor solution of... So the fact that this looks like that and this is so universal is nothing other than the fact that we are in this attractor solution. Inflation is this attractor solution that once something crosses the horizon, it becomes unobservable. Okay, but now you can see that the last comment that I will make is the following. So imagine. So if two things. If we were to go out and measure this, and we didn't, we see some change between the two places, then it can never be produced by single field inflation. So, and we have pretty good measurements of this that we see no change. We see no change to a part in 10 to the 3 or something like that. So this type of non-Gaussianity is in the ideal place for ruling out single field inflation, because it's impossible to change. Because it's just the fact that this clock, that is fluctuations on the clock and this over this attractor solution. So it's like a theorem. This is, I mean, this is Maldacena's theorem, okay? So, the last comment that I will not prove for you is that imagine that the fluctuation. So imagine that okay. I'll prove it in words, okay? So now you can ask the question, what about, let's discuss some other situation in which the fluctuations that we see are not given by this simple example, are not the fluctuations of the clock during inflation. What will happen? Okay, what will happen is that, okay, today, at the end of the day, there are these zeta fluctuations, but during inflation or whatever the period was, abracadabra, where things were being created, there was some other thing. Let's call it sigma, something else. It was fluctuating, okay? It was different in different regions. And somehow, at the end of the day, is this sigma the one that is produced, that then leads to the fluctuations that we see, somehow, okay? What is this somehow? Well, we know what the zeta needs to be at the end of the day. It needs to be that it changes the amount of expansion in different regions. It changed, and this can only be accomplished by changing the equation of state. So what must have happened is that there was some sigma here. It was produced, it crossed the horizon, and at some point or another, this got converted into this zeta. How can it be converted? For example, if this sigma is the mass of some particles, it affects reheating, it affects the... if this sets the mass of some particle, it can affect reheating, it can affect the equation of state. It's easy to do. But what has to happen is that this sigma needs to affect the universe. It needs to affect how the local universe is expanding or doing something, okay? So in examples like this, the universe is not an attractor. The solution is not an attractor. There are many possible values of sigma, and the different values of sigma in different places must affect things, because it needs to make the universe expand by different amounts, right? So the sigma cannot be unobservable once it crossed the horizon because it has to do something. It needs to convert itself to zeta. Okay? So all of these models, the sigma is continues to be observable, and at some point or another, it does something. In fact, what it does is changes the equation of state of the universe. In different regions with different sigma, it has to have different equation of state. But then it can correlate, and in fact, it will correlate long and short modes because every mode is observable at the same time. There is no thing that, oh, this goes outside the horizon, it affects nobody. It all continues. Everybody has to be able to see that there's this sigma there because it needs to change the equation of state. Okay? And in fact, because the Einstein equation is not linear and so on, if you change the equation of state, this delta sigma, say, changes the pressure, it will give you non-linearities, which will give you a non-Gaussianity that of exactly this type, because it must correlate the long and the short modes, and with a coefficient of order 1 in the front at the end of the day, roughly speaking. But unfortunately, our constraint is that the coefficient here is smaller than 5 or something like that. So there's still room to produce the fluctuations in some other way and convert them to zeta and somehow still evade those constraints. But not for long, because that one we can really improve upon in the next few years. This type of non-Gaussianity is the easiest to improve. And we are really close to closing this window. And the fact that this is you get something non-zero and of order 1 is not even have to do with generating the fluctuations in inflation. People that do something else, I don't know, contraction, blah, 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 they cannot produce it by the clock because the clock only scale invariant fluctuations of a clock is during the sitter. They have to produce it during, if they don't want to do inflation, they do something else. So their clock is not the one, so they have to produce it by somebody else. Then then it's not an attractor. The sigma is different. Every scale talk to each other. Long modes talk to short modes. The nonlinearity of the Einstein equation and of the conversion mechanism always give you something. Okay, so that is this consistency condition is super powerful, I think, in testing. Whether we are talking about the fluctuations of the clock, and if we are talking about the fluctuations of the clock, it has to be during inflation, okay? Because during other periods, with this exercise, where did I assume what the history was when I picked h of t here? But the same identical exercise you can do for any h of t. In fact, we can use all of this story for our current fluctuations in the matter area. We can use the same kind of language. But then you can analyze with this the fluctuations in some other contracting universe, blah, blah, blah. Same story. And you will discover that this mode of fluctuations, the clock fluctuations, are not scale invariant in any other thing other than pretty much than inflation. So that is super interesting, I think, this consistency condition. And I think in the near future, meaning decade or so, we will start improving again. We kind of saturated what we can do with the CMB, but so the other pros will need to catch up. But I think they will be able to catch up, and I think it's very interesting. Okay, let me finish there because I spent too much time. Questions?
And multi-field and non-inflationary models.
Yes.
So if we...
Well, a single field, I mean, it's even more. I mean, I didn't even have to assume that the clock was a scalar field, okay?
Yeah.
Fluctuations of the clock or whatever sets time during the sitter background and everybody else. Whatever that is.
Okay, so Matthias is still around for another day, and we have still two more small lectures tomorrow, so you can also ask tomorrow. But let's thank Matthias again.